guys. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. My name is Dick, and this time we begin the TechNet for the 1535th time, 1535 number of this particular TechNet. As you guys have heard so often, we gather every Sunday night to teach each other wireless engineering, radio techniques, transmission lines and antennas and transmitters and receivers and propagation, all the stuff that's connected with it. People sign in because they do have a question or a comment, and they give us their call letters and their name. For the first hour, we take general questions. After that, John, KC2WGB, opens up the mailbag, and we read a few of the questions. Let me drop it. A few of the questions from people who don't yet have their ham license or don't yet have the right equipment so they can talk to us directly. The TechNet is a live give and take on the air. We do not promise that this is a free written consulting service where you can just write us letters and you're going to get answers to those. That's beyond the call of duty of what we have volunteered for. We, meaning Dick, K2RIW, John, KC2WGB, Paul, WS2N, who reads us the space report as to what NASA has been doing. And quite often we also hear from Al, K6DPZ, who has a lot of radio experience. At this time, we're going to take check-ins. Give me your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment. K2RIW.
WB2, America, Hotel Kilowatt. Yes.
In America, Hotel Kilowatt. What is your name, sir?
My name is Chet Charlie Hotel Echo Tokyo.
Okay. Alpha Hotel Kilo, Chet, we got you. Anyone else to check in? Give me your call letters and name. And the word yes.
Star Queen Uniform, John, and yes.
Okay, we got you, John. Fox Red Queen Uniform. And by the way, Fox Red Queen Uniform, are you mobile tonight?
Yes, Dick. Yes, I am. But I'll be within range. Thank you.
Very fine, John. Okay, we've got Chet and John. Anyone else to check in? Give me your call letters and name at this time. K2RIW. One last call. Anyone with any questions or comments for the net? Give me your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment. And do that right now.
KD2HKN, Paul.
Okay, you set up pretty fast, Paul. KD2, it sounded like HDN, Hotel Delta November. Why don't you correct me on that one, Paul?
My apologies, Hotel Kilo November.
Okay, Hotel Kilo November. We got you, Paul. One last call. Anyone else? Give me your call letters and name right now.
K2DMB, Al.
Okay, Alan, is that K2 Delta Mike Victor? In other words, Department of Motor Vehicles, is that what it is, Al?
Department of Motor Vehicles, correct.
Oh, we got you, Al. Okay, Chet, you're number one on the runway. Fire away with your question. WB2 Alpha Hotel Kilo, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Okay, gentlemen, well, Dick and everybody else, my question concerns a subject you touched on a few times in the past few weeks. This question is in regards to feeding a half-wave HF dipole at one of the outer ends. I have three questions. Question one, I assume it's correct to have to place an insulator across the middle of the dipole. Question two, let's assume I have a 36-foot long 20-meter dipole with three egg insulators, one at either end, and of course one in the middle. If I would want to connect a balanced or coax feed line to the antenna near one of the ends, how close to the ends of the dipole could or should the transmission feed line be attached? Would I be connecting the feed line as one normally does, or would I be connecting just one side of the feed line at the outer part of the element radiating wire, leaving one side of the feed line unattached? And my last question, question number three, of the same antenna, a 36-foot, 20-meter dipole, what would be the possible impedance at the end feeding point, and also considering the possibility that it's a high voltage point and not a current point, how do I attempt to match it to the line? Over.
You got a good set of questions there, Chip. Glad you asked them, because that's something I have not been making clear. A half-wave dipole, which is electronically a half-wave, and it's really going to be something like 95% of a half-wave because of the end capacitive effects, make it a little bit shorter when it hits resonance. And if you're feeding it in the center, yes, you do have a center egg insulator. And the transmission line, as far as the dipole is concerned, the transmission line looks almost like a short circuit to the dipole, even though that's where the energy is being fed in. The dipole itself is a resonant circuit, not too different from your child swinging on a swing. It's a resonant circuit. And just with a light finger touch, as long as you do it with the right timing, as long as the swing has got a good high efficiency set of ball bearings at the top, just by pushing with your finger after a small number of cycles, as long as you do it with proper timing, the child will be up to a fairly large swing magnitude. Let me drop. By a large swinging magnitude, in other words, there's quite a bit of stored energy in the velocity that the child has as it goes through the bottom of the swinging motion, and the amount of altitude they've got at the top of the swinging motion. So quite a bit of energy is built up. A dipole has that exact same characteristic. The feed line is feeding in a little bit of energy on each cycle, but the energy bouncing back and forth across the dipole is where the majority of the energy is. The stored energy in that dipole is 10 times higher than the energy that you're putting in at any one instant of time. And as I've often said, you can feed the dipole anywhere along the length. In the center, 10% off to the center, halfway off from the center to the edge, or the outer edge. When you move the feed point, the rest of the dipole stays as a solid piece of wire. When you go all the way out to the end point and feed it at the end, and by the way, the impedance gets higher and higher as you go further and further out. The output side impedance is something in the vicinity of 2,000 ohms, 2,500 ohms, in that vicinity. And the center insulator goes away. You don't use the center insulator when you're feeding the outer edge. You want a half wavelength of continuous conducting wire when you're feeding that outer edge. Let me drop. And this is not too different from pushing a child on the swing. You could, if you want to, stand on a step ladder off to one side and push the rope of the that goes down to the swing. You could push the rope relatively close to the pivot point near the top, and you'd have to push a little bit harder. That's the lower impedance point, but you could get the child swinging very nicely, pushing the rope fairly close to the bearing, halfway between the bearing and the seat, or all the way down at the bottom. When you're pushing all the way down at the bottom, that's the highest impedance point. That's the equivalent of pushing a dipole, of feeding a dipole at the outer edge. When you feed the dipole at the outer edge, the one difficulty that's a little bit unusual, that most of us don't have a lot of experience, is that you need an impedance stepping up device. An impedance stepping up device can be nothing more than a simple L network. One inductor, one capacitor. Your next question is going to be, what size inductor and what size capacitor? And the easiest way to find that is by way of the so-called Berkeley program. If you Google the word Berkeley plus impedance match, B-E-R-K-E-L-E-Y with a plus sign, impedance match, you will find the so-called Berkeley program. Let me drop. Which is done by Berkeley University in California. Some very smart engineers out there. And it asks you the question, what is the impedance of your load? What's the impedance of your signal generator? And what frequency are you operating at? In your case, if you were feeding the dipole in the center, impedance would be 72 ohms. Your transmitter maybe would have an output of 50 ohms, and you want an impedance match between the two, and you would feed in your frequency. In your case, it might be 14.1 megahertz, because you're doing it at 20 meters. You plug in those three pieces of information, and you press go, and in about 1 second, you get 16 answers. 16 separate answers, if I remember correctly. L network with the LC, CL, Pi networks, Pi T networks. You choose the one that you like, and they give you all the values. And when it comes to winding a coil of that size, you know that the Berkeley program will tell you you need, let me pick a number, 2.1 microhenries. And now you're about to ask, how do I make a coil of 2.1 microhenries? Let me drop it. You open up the Radio Amateurs Handbook, the Handbook for Radio Amateurs, I think it's called, and we all call it the Radio Amateurs Handbook, and I think it's on chapter 2 or 3, where they talk about inductors and capacitors. There you'll find a formula where it asks you how many turns are in the coil, what's the diameter of the coil. You plug in the numbers, and it'll tell you how many microhenries you're going to get. So you can decide you're going to wind that coil on a piece of PVC tubing. Your piece of PVC tubing that you just happen to have in your hand is 2 inches in diameter. So you know the coil is going to have 2 inches in diameter. And some number of turns, you plug into that formula, it's going to give you 2.1 microhenries. That was my example, if you know what I mean. And the capacitor, how many picofarads is required, Berkeley is going to tell you that. And you might need a air variable capacitor because the voltage is going to be a little bit high. Or maybe it's going to be a transmitting grade capacitor. And maybe you're going to be adjusting it for the fine tuning to get exactly the right amount of resonance by squeezing and stretching the turns of the coil a little bit. Let me drop. So if you plugged in 2,000 ohms for the outer impedance at the tip, and in your case 14.1 megahertz, the Berkeley program will tell you exactly how to make that LC network that's going to step up the impedance from your 50 ohm transmission line up to the approximately 2,000 ohms that you get at the tip of the dipole. In that case of feeding the outer tip, the elegant way to do it, and you might be doing this, say, for instance, at a field day site, where the wire is a piece of vertical wire with a bow and arrow or with a slingshot. You've strung a string over the top of a nearby tree. You've holed up your wire. Your 36 feet of wire is now hanging vertically 36 feet in the air, and the bottom of it is going to go to the LC network. The LC network is going to be fed by your coax cable, and the LC network really has two output connectors. One goes to the wire, and the other one is going to go to a grounding rod. In the case of a vertical dipole fed from the outer edge, let me drop the call. Because the impedance is so high, the current that you're feeding is going to be so low, one simple grounding rod in the ground would do the job correctly. Or if you were building a similar 20-meter dipole, 20-meter half-wave dipole, and you were using a helically wound structure like you can buy from CB antennas, where it would be physically considerably shorter than 36 feet, but you're feeding the outer edge of this resonant structure, and guys have done that on the balcony of their apartment, where the grounding rod becomes the metal railing of the apartment balcony. And it's more than enough for grounding, so to speak, when you're feeding the high impedance point at the outer edge. You will also periodically find articles where somebody says, gee, feeding the outer edge is very uncomfortable because it's an unbalanced feeding network. You're going to get current flowing on the outside of the coax cable. Good sounding theory. Almost dead wrong. Let me drop. Let's assume now that the impedance out there is 2,000 ohms. And if you're feeding the dipole in the center of the usual balancing structure, you're feeding it at 50 ohms. The difference between 50 ohms and 2,000 ohms is, I think, a 40-to-1 ratio. In other words, because you're feeding the outer tip, you're feeding an impedance that's roughly 40 times higher. That means the voltage that you're developing on that L network is going to be 40 times higher, and the current is going to be 40 times lower. So even if the circuit didn't have a real good grounding rod, and even if some extra current is going to flow down the outside of the coax cable, if every bit of that current flowed down the outside of the coax cable because you had a really bad, yucky ground and no ground at all, by definition, the current is going to be 40 times lower than it would normally be when you're feeding the coax at the center of the dipole in a normal manner, no matter what that current is. When it's 40 times lower, it's probably minuscule. And so these people who worry about this, they're being a grandmother, if you know what I mean, and they don't understand the physics of what they're doing. So there are a number of guys who have set up this kind of a structure that I just described. One simple piece of wire, in your case 36 feet long, strung up in a tree, and the bottom being fed on the outer edge, and those who have done it have said, boy, that works very well. How come somebody hasn't told me about this sooner? Let me drop them. Now, your third question I'm going to jump to is, what is the impedance of the outer end? We've just covered that. It's approximately 2,000 ohms. And by the way, you can also find out the exact impedance for whatever diameter wire you've got, whatever frequency you're feeding it at. You can find out the exact impedance from the so-called Brown and Woodward curves. The Brown and Woodward curves, you're going to find them in many places, but one of the places is at the website of what we call Mike Number 2. Mike Number 2 is LimarkTechnet.com. Limarc, L-I-M-A-R-C, LimarkTechnet, all of them slung together, T-E-C-H-N-E-T, LimarkTechnet.com. And there you will find, under impedance matching the dipole by K2LAW, under that article you'll find these two Brown and Woodward curves. One curve gives you the impedance for the resistive component. The other curve gives you the reactive component of impedance. What the curve requires, it's multiple curves on an XY plot. Let me drop. The horizontal axis represents frequency, but it's labeled in degrees. So if you are feeding a quarter wave monopole, for instance, a quarter wave is one quarter of 360 degrees, 90 degrees. So you'd go to the horizontal point that's 90 degrees if you want to build a quarter wave device, quarter wave ground plane. And the vertical axis will tell you how many ohms you're going to get of resistance, and the other curve will tell me how many ohms of reactance you're going to get once you know the diameter and the length of your particular piece of wire. If you make it longer than quarter wave, it might be 100 degrees instead of 90 degrees long. And what exact impedance you're going to get, those two curves are going to give you, and that is the answer you're looking for. And that is not theoretical data. That is real, hard, measured data. Mr. Brown and Mr. Woodward spent roughly a man year of their life in 1946 measuring all of that data for all of those dots on all of those curves. Let me drop. In my mind, that is extremely valuable data. No matter what diameter wire, no matter what length you've got, no matter what frequency you've got, that tells you exactly what impedance you're going to get. Extremely useful data. Every single issue of the four issues, four or five editions of the Antenna Engineering Handbook has those curves in it. And arguably it's the most valuable information that's in that 1,200-page book, if you know what I mean. You now know impedance, you now know how to feed it, you know how to do the impedance matching. And if you're feeding a dipole in the center, let me drop. The way guys have done it for years and years, it's not the ideal way, but it works. You take your coax cable, you strip the end of it, and you've got a shield and a center conductor, and you've got a center insulator on your half-wave dipole, and you connect the shield to one half of the dipole, and you connect the center conductor to the other half of the dipole. That works. But because the coax cable is a so-called unbalanced feed line, that's a fancy way of saying that all of the energy is supposed to be on the inside of that cable, inside of the inner conductor, inner surface of that outer conductor, and between it and the center conductor. But when you open up the end of the cable and you connect it in that manner, now energy flows out to the dipole just like it's supposed to. Some of the energy now flows back into the shield of the dipole, and therefore the outer shield of the dipole becomes, the outer shield of your transmission line becomes hot. And depending on the length of that transmission line and whether or not it hits resonance, you might have some RF in the shack. And the worst case of RF in the shack I know of, if a guy is using a metal D104 microphone and he steps up real close to the microphone and he's running 200 watts of power, he might get a slight spark that jumps between the microphone and his lip as he speaks into that microphone. That's the worst case situation. And RF in the shack could give you a little bit of extra television interference or some funny action of your rig. In order to avoid that problem, you either build or buy a balancing device. The poor man's balancing device is simply a few turns of the coax cable taped together right at the feed point of the dipole. That becomes a series RF choke. And so, let me drop. Even though that method of connecting to the dipole will launch some RF energy into the outer shield of your coax cable, because you've got a few turns of that cable right there acting as an RF choke, 90% of it will stop right there and just slow down the rest of the cable. That's the poor man's Balun. Works like a charm. The elegant Balun is where you buy one of these devices that's made just for doing this service. And if you take apart one of these things, it's usually a white tubular piece of PVC tubing about 2 inches in diameter, about 10 inches long, with two nice big eye hooks on the side where you connect the dipole, two halves of the dipole, another eye hook at the top where you hang it from, and a UHF connector at the bottom. If you take that apart, what would you find inside? You'd find a whole bunch of ferrite toroids that are stacked on the outside of the coax cable that flows down the center of that structure. Those toroids are really a sophisticated RF choke, which again stops any current from flowing down the outside of the cable below where it's connected, and the rest of the cable that goes down to the shack, if you know what I mean. That's the sophisticated way of doing it. So hopefully this answers many of your questions on the dipole. Dipole is probably the most basic of all antennas we use. It's good to learn exactly how it works. You'll be amazed at the 5,000 kinds of antennas that are in the world. You'll be amazed what percentage of those antennas have a dipole or a half dipole, a monopole, somewhere in the middle of that antenna, which really starts the whole process working. WB2, Alpha Hotel Kilo, K2LIW, you got it, Chad.
All right, WB2HK, thank you for all the information. What's happening is, in my neck of the woods, and I'm putting up more and more antennas, and I'm starting to get feedback from the neighbors about how ugly it is to be living next to me and ruining their evaluation of their houses, and to be stringing up another HF dipole with the coax coming down the middle hanging up in the air is only going to add to their aggravation. And I was thinking that it would be so much neater and nicer if I could I operate near a window over here, and if I could just have a wire going out the window, from the window area, let's say, with an insulator, of course, heading to a tree, a straight piece of wire, that wouldn't be so ugly. It might not even be noticed because there's no coax hanging down in the middle. The only trouble is I'm on a second floor, Dick, and I don't have a ground rod going up to the second floor. And if I drop the piece of wire down into the alleyway, I'm almost like heading into like the different territory of residence, wouldn't I be? Because I have no ground there, no actual ground rod. And if I start putting a piece of wire hanging down from, let's say, from the shield side of a coax or something, I'd be heading into a different frequency range, heading to the next band towards 40 meters, let's say, not quite, but. So how do I overcome not having a ground rod? We're at the outer end of the convenient feed point. Any ideas?
DBZ, comment. I'll recognize, yes, I've got lots of ideas. And you've got nowhere near as bad a problem as you think. First of all, every diagram you've ever seen of a dipole, it's always shown as a thoroughly horizontal piece of wire parallel to the earth if it's horizontally polarized and occasionally vertically polarized. But you're led to believe it's got to be a completely flat-out, straight piece of wire. As long as the wire itself is a resonant length, you can do all kinds of things with it. You can put a loading coil in the center on each half, to right side and left side, in order to make it physically shorter but still be resonant. You can zigzag the wire left and right, up and down. The ends of the wire can be bent down. When you make all of these mechanical changes that I'm describing, and then you remeasure the performance of the antenna in gain and pattern, you'll be amazed how extremely minor is the difference because of all those great big physical changes you've made. Let me drop. So you might find out that you've got a real nice high tree that's three stories high on two parts of your property. You want to hang the dipole at a nice altitude, three stories high, and then one of the ends of the dipole, you bend it down and bring it to your second floor window where you're feeding the outer edge. That would work like a charm. And whether or not you ground that L network that I described, becomes a little bit academic. It turns out that the so-called NFED ZEP antenna, ZEP stands for Zeppelin, where when you're flying around in a balloon and you worry about where the hell is ground, ground is there, it's 5,000 feet below you. Will the antenna work? It works like a charm. That is an NFED antenna at the outer edge where the impedance is high. And yes, they use the rest of the metal structure of the Zeppelin as a kind of a ground. In your case, the grounding rod could be the metal railing of your balcony or of your apartment, if you had one. It could even be the local water pipe. It could be the hot water from the baseboard radiation pipe. And with a slight amount of risk, it could even be the third wire of the 110-volt wiring. Because the impedance is 20 times higher. Is it 20 times higher, I think it is? 40 times higher. The impedance is 40 times higher than the 50 ohms of your transmitter. Let me drop. If you had no ground at all, and just took the piece of coax cable and where it ended, send a conductor goes to your... here we go. Semiconductor and shield goes to the L network. The L network really is an inductor and a capacitor which has a local ground. Local ground meaning the shield has to go there and the semiconductor has to go to a certain point of the L network. And the output of the L network, the high impedance point, the 2,000 ohm point, is going to go to the wider of the dipole. And if this is the best of all worlds, the so-called common point ground that I just described would go to a grounding rod, would go to the railing of the balcony of your apartment, or would go to the household wiring. If you did nothing with that, it would really be like the NFED Zeppelin antenna. You would get almost all the important impedance you want. You might have a little bit of RF current flowing on that cable, but the current is going to be 40 times lower than normal. I think you can get away with it. There are ways that you can hang a piece of wire down to the ground and force that piece of wire to be a resonant length, an even number of quarter wavelengths is what I'm trying to say. An even number of quarter wavelengths will make the grounding rod and the top of the wire where you are act like it's the exact same point. That would also be a very sophisticated way of doing it, which would not be shifting the impedance. Guarantee Hal's got a couple of other ways of feeding this NFED ZEP. And if you want to read more about the antenna that you're building, NFED ZEP is the very closest thing I know of. K6DPZ, K2RIW, you've got it now.
2RIW, K6DPZ, okay, I want to say hi to everybody on the net. All right, well, one suggestion is, you know, people think about making J antennas for VHF and UHF. You can make a J for 20 meters. If you have a J for 20 meters, a quarter wave section driving a half wave section, there's no ground required on the counterpoise. And if you have enough wire length, you got an antenna that doesn't need ground, then it works beautifully. The main thing is having enough distance to run that wire. That's my comment, Dick. I was just sitting here, you know, thinking about it. We built the J on 20, and we had some phenomenal results. K2RIW, this is K6 Darling Purple Zombies.
Very good information, Hal. The J antenna is another way of feeding it that has its own local ground, the J antenna feeding mechanism. So it's just a structure you build to feed the outer end of the wire, that's the half-wave dipole, and this J structure really is a distributed network that is the L network of a lumped inductor and lumped capacitor that I was talking about before. Hal, by the way, you've got to back off on your audio a healthy 6 dB. You're almost putting out square waves. Very heavy on the audio. But we heard everything you said. Good information. So Hal's suggestion is feeding it with a J monopole or J dipole, I think they call it. Mine was feeding it with lumped element inductor and capacitor as a LC network. You'll be amazed how easy this thing is to work. Chet, you'll be amazed how easy this thing is to work. It'll require very little experimentation. And with your particular setup, there's various ways that you can set this up so that the neighbors will see nothing but the wire. And one of your next questions is going to be, what would happen if I built my antenna out of 30-gauge wire instead of 14-gauge wire to make it more invisible? Would there be a difference in performance? The answer would be very little difference in performance. So simple piece of wire without a piece of big fat coax. Let me drop it. Without a big fat piece of coax going to it, a simple piece of wire to the average human eye of a neighbor is almost invisible. Very few neighbors look up in the air, and when they do not see wire. All of that wiring out in front of the street from Con Ed and Long Island Lighting Company, people do not see that wire. A fat piece of coax cable going to the center of your dipole, yeah, they sort of see that. But other than that, you can string up a whole lot of these wires on various bands in various directions, and once your neighbors turn a little bit reasonable, they're not going to see it. And if they think that a simple piece of wire up in the air is going to change property values, that's really stretching it as I see it, Chet. WB2AHK, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, kind of quirky. Do we sound better?
You're still very heavy, but you sound a lot better.
Okay, WB2AHK, I am. Okay, good, that's great. I'll be working on it in my mind now, what I'm going to put up, because I don't have really much of any. I have a lot of UHF and VHF and a lot of stuff on the chimneys, and I had like 8 things on my chimney. And one day somebody I was talking to outside my house said, "Oh my God, what is all that stuff up on your chimney?" And then, of course, I have other antennas elsewhere. And I looked at it and I said, "Oh my God, I've been here for like 23 years and I didn't realize I kept putting things up on my chimney. And I didn't realize how ugly it, even for me, a ham of 53 years, I didn't realize how ugly it got, not knowing, you know, what it looked like, literally looked like. So a few months ago, 3 months ago, I took the ladder and I took off quite a few antennas that I wasn't even using anymore. I kept adding but never taking down anything. So, anyhow, very good idea, yeah. They won't see that wire going off into the distance there, and I'll load it by my window. They won't notice that. Great idea. Thanks so much, Dick. Great, great, great. Now I got all the info I need to put something together. You answered all my questions. Okay, back to you, Dick. WB2AHK, the American Ham Kid.
N2EO, Dick. N2EO, an offshoot on Jeff's question.
KC2WGB, John, sounds like we've got a happy customer there with Chet. We're going to have to send him a bill. Go ahead. Have you built NSAID dipoles? Is that what you're saying, Rich? Into EO, K2RIW in the TechNet? And by the way, Chet, when you do make this work, please come back and let us know how well it worked. You've got it, Rich.
Hey, Dick, I've been thinking about an NSAID ZEP for the spring. But I wanted to ask you, I'm going to feed it with ladder line, which is a normal procedure with that, and I'm going to go to a tuner, and then up to the radio, which is going to be, when I get the money, it's going to be a Kenwood TS-2000. Question, MFJ, which is owns the Meritron, they got 2 types of tuners. They got regular tuner with a balun in it, so you can match open wire line. And then they have a balanced fed tuner, which has 2 Golo inductors. Which would you prefer, or do you think it makes any difference?
Okay, whether or not the antenna tuner you buy has a balun built in or doesn't have one built in is a relatively minor factor to me, because one band at a time to build a so-called half-wave coax balun, which is really a half-wave of coax looped back on itself, shields connected together, and the transmission line going into this thing, all 3 of those shields go together, and the center conductor goes to one side of the center conductor of the U-shape. Anyhow, a so-called half-wave coaxial balun does a beautiful job of converting 50 ohms unbalanced into 200 ohms balanced. Yes, your open wire line maybe is going to be 600 ohms, 400 ohms, so you're going to get a slight impedance mismatch, but that's a 2-to-1 or a 3-to-1 standing wave ratio, and the antenna tuner itself can easily handle that. So whether you buy an antenna tuner with the balun is a dual sheeter inside or outside, and you build it with a half-wave coax panel. In. That's a minor detail. You can easily handle that one. The slight advantage of building the balun built in is that you don't have to build a half-wave coax balun for each individual band. And because of the way they work, let me think, there may be a way of building a half-wave coax balun so that it runs on two bands at once. I'll have to study that one. You'd have to have a 3-to-1 frequency relationship. And do any of our bands have a 3-to-1? They all have a 2-to-1. So cancel that one. But that's a minor detail, Rich. Don't let that be a showstopper. If somebody gives you an antenna tuner, let me drop.
Hey, 40 and 15 meters, Dick.
Give that man a cigar. 40 and 15 meters, he's right. So you build a half-wave coax balun for 40 meters. It will work on 15 meters simultaneously. So you could feed a pair of twin leads that feed two separate antennas. So, well done. Somebody gives you an antenna tuner, and it doesn't contain the balun. Don't let that be a showstopper. The price is right, if you know what I mean. John, Kilo 2, Foxtrot, Quebec Uniform, Mobile, K2RIW. You got it, John.
Thank you, K2RIW, K2FQU, and FNET. My question is on a torch, a blowtorch, either a MAP or propane, in order to braise aluminum foil off of an RP6 coax. I was able to get powder paste that the melting point or flux point for it to liquidize is 395 Fahrenheit. And I wanted to know what torch I could use in order to relatively heat up the, heat up the paste on the aluminum foil braid on this RG6 line in order to tin it and then solder it to copper wire.
Yeah, I see your question, John, and I'm going to try very strong to talk you out of it. I think the last thing in the world you want to try to do is solder to that very thin aluminum foil of RG6 cable, and in some cases it's a mylar film with an aluminum coating on the mylar. There isn't even anything there you can solder to. But even if you succeeded in soldering to it, in my opinion it would be an extremely unreliable joint, particularly if one end of it is out in the weather, being exposed to rain, salt spray, heat, cold, ice, whatever. Your RG6 cable comes with, or you can install, the right kind of a tight F connector on it, among other kinds. The RG6 cable and the RG59 cable are slightly different in diameter. Therefore, in the bubble packs at Radio Shack, you've got two different kinds of F connector, crimp connectors. Make sure you get the one that's made for RG6, or you're going to buy the RG6 with a connector on the end of it already. Once the connector is already on the end of it, F connector, and then from you to convert from that F connector over to any other kind of connector you want, BNC, UHF, type N, or whatever. That's easy. And people will try to lead you to believe, some people will try to lead you to believe that each connector and each interface has insertion loss. Absolutely not. The only thing in the RF world that has loss is something that's either made out of a resistive material or something that has real significant physical length. Your coax cable might have 3 dB of loss per 100 feet because of its length, and you're lighting up 100-foot length of polyethylene insulating material between that center conductor and the outer shield of that 100 feet of cable, and that's where the insertion loss is coming from, and 100 feet of copper for the center conductor, and 100 feet of braid. That's where the loss is coming from, length. All of the adapters that you and I build that are not made out of rusty materials, that's got some kind of a paste in there that's conductive, if you know what I mean, because it was sitting in salt water for the last 5 years in your basement. Other than those extreme conditions, there is no significant measurable insertion loss of any kind of a connector or adapter, as long as it can pass the visual test where you look at it and it doesn't look like it's filled up with green moss, if you know what I mean. Let me drop. So for you to adapt from the F connector on the end of a piece of RG6 cable into any other kind of a structure, even if you have to screw it into another F connector and you solder to the outer threaded region of that other female F connector, that would be a reliable contact. But for you to try to solder to that foil or the braid or whatever of RG6, if it was a copper braid, yes, but very few of the brands of RG6 have a copper braid in the outside. Many of them do have this foil. And for you to make a solder joint to that foil is almost out of the question. If you were an extremely good jeweler with a microscope and you'd made a whole lot of individual bonding wires to that, yes, you could establish contact to it. But that's way beyond the skill of any normal amateur. I strongly recommend you don't do it. The crimp connector made for RG6 does a beautiful job of giving you contact all the way around the perimeter, and it's held together real tight. Do you see where I'm going with that one, John? You've used some good common sense in what you're trying to do, but you talk to anybody who's really been there, and on a number of occasions I've tried soldering to aluminum or aluminum foil. And if you say that 98% of the time it doesn't work, that's very close to what's going on here. K2 Foxtrot Quebec Uniform Mobile, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Thank you very much, Dick. K2RIW, K2FQU. I have a plethora of PPC F-type connections. That's not a problem. It was just feeding it into a dipole. And the dipole is not even meant to sit out in the weather. It's just meant for a portable or quick setup. So it's just like experimenting-wise. That's pretty much what my question was. So as you're saying, instead of trying to attach the RG6 to the dipole or the copper wire, of course, that would be used for the dipole, I should just connect possibly SO239 connector, one for the outer end, a copper wire, and then another one to the center conductor, and then use an adapter for the F connection onto that.
You've got it, John. You're going to be worrying about the physical length of that adapter and what it changes to wavelength and tuning of the dipole. You're worrying about secondary and tertiary effects here, which are very easy to compensate. If you've got an antenna tuner of a large enough tuning range, you could take I'm going to take an example, an 80-meter dipole, which ordinarily would be 132-foot length of 14-gauge wire. 80-meter dipole on 3.6 megacycles is roughly 132 feet long. And you could shrink it down to some ridiculous length, like 32 feet instead of 132 feet. And you go to the Brown and Woodward curve, I don't know the exact numbers, but you're probably going to find out it's got a capacitive reactance of 4,000 ohms and a resistive component of 8 ohms. So it's an 8-ohm resistor in series with a 3,500 ohm capacitor, so to speak, because you've made it 32 feet long instead of 132 feet long. Electronically, that homely antenna that's extremely small in size that I just described, if you've got an antenna tuner with a wide enough tuning range, that antenna could give you 95% of the performance of a full half-wave dipole at the resonant frequency where you tune the antenna tuner. The infinitesimal dipole, as you go all the way down to zero in length, and that's the extreme example here of using adapters and whatever that are changing length. Here I'm going small, and you can also go big. You can make the wire too long and yet re-impedance match it. Except for the fact that it becomes a narrow band antenna, and you've got to readjust the controls every time you QSY 50KC. Other than that minor detail, radio-wise, it'll have full performance. Of course, that doesn't make common sense. Let me drop.
I have a comment, Dick. I have a comment I was waiting for.
You would think that the effective capture area is going to be a small fraction because you've made the wire physically smaller. The magic of resonance, once you resonate that structure with the antenna tuner or any other doodad you put on, and once you force it into resonance, it develops the full effective capture area. Of course, that sounds crazy. You go and do the test, you plug the numbers into the formulas that I can tell you about, and you'll be amazed how much that's true. Okay, so two transmissions ago, Mel, here we go. Wes had a question. N2XJN, K2RIW, go ahead, Wes.
Yeah, there is a certain dependency between the cable quality, or the shield quality, in particular voltage handling capability and the frequency. My question is, we have a cheap wire with the aluminum foil on it. At what frequency we see a drastic difference between the cheap crap and the good quality of the copper shielding? Also, some of the of those coaxial cables, they have a copper shielding that is barely a cup. You can put the finger between that, and it's gonna touch the insulation. And if some of them have a very good or even double shielding, so you could save your words on it.
Yeah, when I talked to my friend who lives in Chile, I'm trying to think of the name of the town, La Salina, Chile, and I once knew the capital of Chile, even if he goes to the capital of Chile and he goes to the best electronics store and he buys the best coax cable he can buy, and he strips off the outer black jacket and he looks at the braid, the braid is giving him about 50% coverage. In other words, he can look through the strands of the braid and see an awful lot of the dielectric material. So the material he can buy locally is really low in quality. He can import coax cable from the United States, but now to get it through customs is a real rigmarole. He has to bribe people in order for the cable to come through customs in some reasonable length of time, less than 6 months. So there are portions of the world where coax cable is pretty yucky by our standards. And what happens if you do a test of that kind of cable that's got very minuscule braid? Ordinary coax cable built the correct way at most of the frequencies where you use it gives you a healthy 60 decibels of shielding. When you've got a very light braid like that, maybe you've got 35 or 40 dB of shielding. So some of the signal is slowly leaking out along the length because of that braid. Now, a number of kinds of cable have both braid and foil simultaneously. We drop. In the case of, what's it called, RG6? No, not RG6. FM8, that's not it. What's the, one of the very popular cables that is a slightly larger center conductor. It's got air as the primary dielectric. A popular cable, I can't think of the name of it right now, has a foil. And the foil represents a weather shield. There are some quality made cables that have both braid and foil. So just because you see... What was that again?
9913,
thank you. Barry, your audio is very low for the last day or so on that particular rig. Yes, 9913 is the one I'm thinking of. At 9913, some of the earlier versions, the water would slowly migrate from the outside world into the cable, and a year later you got a very change, a big change in performance. The later versions of 9913 do have a foil on the outside of the braid, and the foil is a quasi-hermetic seal. It turns out that water vapor will slowly go through the polyvinyl chloride outer black jacket. That outer black jacket is a weather seal. It is not a hermetic seal. Water vapor will slowly migrate through that. And the later versions, the better made versions of 9913, have got this foil that is a much closer to a hermetic seal. So just because you see foil in a cable doesn't mean the cable is cheap. So, and yes, there are cheap cables that have foil. So there's more going on than the first meets the eye. K2 KC2WGB, K2LIW. Go ahead, John.
KC2WGB. Yes, Dick, you know that conversion he's looking to do, you and I work with a lot of instrumentation cables, where I've run into that problem. I use an adapter that will change it from F to BNC, or you can get one that will go from an F connector to banana plug. And you'll have two connections at the end of this little adapter. And to hook that to an antenna somewhere, no problem. That's the best way to go. You don't have to worry about making any special grounds. It all threads up and mates perfectly. KC2WGB, back to you, Dick.
Well done, John number one. And John number two is FQU. And I hope I've discouraged you to try to solder to that braid. To that foil. That foil is probably a 1/10000th of an inch thick, and the way soldering works, you literally have to make in the case of soldering copper, there really is a solder copper compound in the outer 1/10000th of an inch of the two wires that you're soldering together, and there isn't enough thickness in the aluminum foil to do that, if you know what I mean. So you can't get a reliable joint. I, for instance, have done aluminum soldering on Bud chassis where I wanted a real good joint where the folds of the chassis come together in order to get very good shielding. And even in an indoor environment, very carefully done aluminum soldering with just the right fluxes and just the right equipment, it gives you a joint, but aluminum oxide is always forming, and a couple of years downrange, you find that joint doesn't have anywhere near the integrity you think it does. You want to make a good joint to aluminum, it better be something like a stainless steel screw, and I don't think I would trust solder in most cases. Aluminum soldering is an art and science that's very difficult, and the alloy of aluminum that's used on Bud chassis, let me drop it. That alloy of aluminum, I haven't yet found a good way of aluminum soldering, even though you buy these various kits that claim they do very good aluminum soldering. So, and when it comes to an aluminum soldered joint exposed to outdoor weather, I'm almost of the opinion you cannot make that a reliable joint. So don't depend on it.
Comment, Dick.
Go ahead, John.
KC2WGB. Dick, the only way I've found a positive type of connections that work well below 500 megahertz was to wrap many turns of the copper wire, let's see, like maybe 22 gauge around it with some conductive compound, a little bit of it. Wrap it really tight around that. That's if it's aluminum foil, not the plastic, and then put heat shrink on it and pull it down. That will maintain contact, and it works. I found up 500 megacycles, and it is durable. That's the only other way. You're right. I don't think soldering is going to work at all.
Yeah, that's some good experience there, John. And by all of that wrapping, you're forming an extremely good parallel multiple plate capacitor. And so that at most of the frequencies you and I care about, that capacitive coupling, even if your ohm meter wouldn't confirm a perfect milli-ohm contact, the capacitive coupling does the job. There are kinds of joints, rotary joints, that are used on things like radar antennas, where the center conductor of the antenna and the center conductor of the transmission line come together with an air gap between the two. And if that air gap is made just the right length, like a quarter wavelength of length with just the right kind of a choking structure, you can have 99.9% of the RF energy flow through that joint, even though absolutely no physical contact takes place. Your ohm meter will tell you that's an open circuit, but at 500 megacycles, it may have a 1/10 of an ohm of resistance or reactance, if you know what I mean, if it's done correctly. So there are various ways of making an RF contact that your ohm meter will not confirm. So tuck that into the back of your brain. It's one of the tricks that we amateurs, or we electronic engineers, use from time to time. The next guy was Kilo Delta 2, Hotel Kilo November. You've got a poll, K2RIW, and the TechNet.
Hi, JD2HKN. Just a quick one. I don't even know if it's practical. I have a base station running right now, just an interim solution until I get a mounted HF antenna. I have a mag mounted antenna onto an air conditioner, and I apparently bought a quad band antenna, and which requires grounding to operate on 10 meters. What would be like the best approach to grounding a mobile antenna for base station usage using a mag mount?
I think the best you could do is mag mount to a chunk of metal that the magnet will stick to, probably steel, or it could even be aluminum, which has a chunk of steel in the back of it so the magnet can suck to it. But from the perimeter of that chunk of metal, you're going to put ground plane radials. Bare minimum of three would do it. Three ground plane radials, a quarter wavelength long, including the length across the sheet metal up to the mag mount antenna. But that would be the best ground in the world. Quarter wavelength radials, because the outer end is a short circuit and every quarter wave inverts impedance. A quarter wave radio at the inner end looks like almost like a perfect short circuit at the frequency of quarter wave resonance. So it doesn't look like a ground. The whole structure could be mounted literally in the air, because you're an astronaut floating behind the space shuttle and you're 160 miles in the air. That will act like a local ground, those three ground plane radials. That's about the best I could think of. Over to you, Paul. KD2HKN, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KD2HKN. I'll give it a try. Again, it's just interim. I was just trying to experiment. So thank you very much for your time.
And even if you use something a lot less than quarter wave radials and three of them, just by putting that mag mount antenna against a refrigerator, an air conditioner, a steam heating radiator, a hot water baseboard radiator, no matter what you stick it against, it's going to work. And as you connect it to a ground that is more and more poor at 10 meters, the net result is that whatever you connect it to becomes the other half of a dipole, so to speak, and you're not feeding it in the center. So if the object you connect it to is less than a quarter wavelength long, you're just feeding an off-center fed dipole, so to speak, which will have a slightly different resonant frequency, a slightly higher standing wave ratio, but at the frequencies you're talking about, some of our rigs are very tolerant. And if you're using an antenna tuner, even that problem would go away. Give it a go. Come back and let us know how well it works, Paul. Al was the next guy on our list. K2, Delta Mike Victor. Department of Motor Vehicles. You've got it, Al. K2RIW in the TechNet.
So you have a question.
Just a
quick thing, and I was happy to be able to finally make a connection to what you said on the live market. And that is it.
Okay, I was a little bit long-winded, Al, and you and I doubled, so please repeat your question. Make sure you wait for the beep before you start transmitting to us. KD2DMV, wait for the three beeps. K2RIW in the TechNet.
I see what you want. All right, I didn't have a question. Back to the net.
Okay, you're just signing into...
All right!
You're just signing in to let us know that you're there. And I usually tell people they don't have to... After... this is year number 32 of the TechNet, and so after 32 years, we believe somebody is listening. That doesn't have to be confirmed to us anymore. Okay, we're exactly at 9 o'clock. Hey, we're on schedule tonight, John. We better make sure we tell everybody not to expect this all the time. It's not going to be that accurate most of the time. KC2, WGB with the mailbag, among other things. And John also keeps track of what's going on with Echo Lake, so that if we don't do the timing correct and you get chopped out and you don't get your edge in word-wise, Echo Link-wise, John watches the computer program and lets us know about that. KC2, WGB, K2RIW. You got it, John.
K2RIY, Joe, can I squeeze a question here before you go to the mailbag?
Okay, we have this late check-in guy who we've never heard of before, some unknown person named Joe. Go ahead, Joe, to be true. I want you good to believe. You got it. You got it, Joe.
Occasionally in the past you've talked about shielding on cabling, like coax cables, hard line, and so forth. Maybe you've explained this in the past, but maybe I'm asking again to go over it again. How do you go about, or how would one go about measuring the shielding